Progressive.fm, bringing you new shows and fresh ideas every day. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us. Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Today's show is about a tragedy, about multiple tragedies, and unfortunately, I'm sure, about tragedies to come. Today is about Newtown, but it's also about Aurora, Colorado, the theater shooting. It's also about Eric Harris and Columbine. It's about many shootings that have gone on in this country. And the results are so far-reaching, both in terms of our society, how we respond, the laws we pass, the reactions we have in general. And, of course, they are incredibly powerful in their toxicity in their local communities. Nothing is more difficult to deal with in life than the traumatic, sudden, unexpected death of a child. And now there are 20 more people in a concentrated area dealing with that. How do we respond? One of my big concerns is the turning to psychiatry, which I'm seeing happening on both the left and the right. Obama, in addition to gun control, is calling for more mental health services. And on sources from the left, you see more about, you know, that this person was crazy and we need to do something to monitor crazy people. On the right, we see this person is crazy and evil and we need to do more to monitor these people and to do something about them. And we have the NRA now coming out and calling for a national mental health registry. I recently wrote a blog that you can find on my website, Bregin.com, Bregin.com, under, you can look up at the Flash News, and it's listed there in terms of mass shooting, about the huge danger of increasing involuntary treatment in this country in order to try, in that potentially vicious and violent web, to catch an occasional, infrequent, rare, violent person. This will be a huge impingement on civil liberties in this country, not of people who are very disturbed, they're already impinged on in their civil liberties, but the net will stretch. And before introducing my guest, I want to add to that that psychiatry has no special capacity to identify violent people. The state mental hospitals were filled with hundreds of thousands of people presumed to be a danger to themselves and others who were mostly helpless. People labeled mentally ill are by and large more helpless than dangerous. They're not more dangerous than the people in the routine population. It's a complex problem, and we have a marvelous guest to help deal with that. His name is Jim Gottstein. Jim is an Alaskan lawyer, and he's been a lifelong advocate for people diagnosed with mental disorders. Like myself, he doesn't accept the concept that these are illnesses. But there certainly are people being labeled, and there are people who have problems taking care of themselves in our world. He's been especially concerned about trying to check the psychiatric drugging of children. Oh, this must sound very familiar to my listeners because it sounds like guess who? He's also working on alternatives to psychiatric drugging in facilities. He's working on a Soteria, Alaska facility. He can tell you about that. His organization that he founded or co-founded is the Law Project for Psych Rights. And you can find him very easily on the web by going to Psych Rights. And Jim, you're there?
Yes.
One of the interesting things I found is that when I would go and look up your name and your picture would pop up, there'd be two or three other pictures and I'd be right there with you. So I guess we are brothers on the web. Welcome to the show. I've been looking forward to talking with you as much as anyone I've ever had on the show.
Well, thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
Where would you like to pick up on these issues?
Well, I mean, the first thing, of course, is that I want to express, you know, my extreme sympathy for the parents and family and friends of the victims and my horror at what happened. I mean, it's one of these things that's just hard to imagine. And when I heard about it, like everyone else, my, you know, I just got sick to my stomach and was horrified. And so, I mean, I think that's, you know, an overriding thought. And but another thought that I had is, and you touched on it, is, and I don't want to even use the word put this into perspective, because you can't really put it into perspective. It's so horrible. But the reality is a couple things, that the psychiatric drugging of children is so pervasive and so harmful that we have many multiples of the Sandy Hook tragedy happening probably at least every year in terms of deaths from these drugs to children, of children by these drugs, and that we've got thousands and thousands of children whose lives are being ruined by these drugs. And so I think it's important to put, you know, put that on the table. The other thing which that really comes to mind for me is that we run in certain circles and we are aware of the impact of psychiatric drugs on violence. And it's such a rare event, but it's also, as you so clearly demonstrated in your book, Medication Madness, there's also not really any legitimate question that in those rare events, the psychiatric drugs cause people to become homicidal. And to me, that's the elephant that's not even in the room in the national discussion. And I guess the last one is, when was it Wayne LaPierre of the National Rifle Association talked about putting armed guards in every school, he basically said we have to stop these monsters. And obviously it was a monstrous act that Adam Lanza did. But I hesitate to call him a monster at this point. We don't even really know that much about Adam and, you know, what happened. And we certainly don't know that it was drugs at this point. But to call him a monster, I think, is kind of premature, if ever really appropriate. And I think what's happened is we're kind of getting a witch hunt against people diagnosed with mental illness, and there are forces that seize on these events to advance their agenda for more coercive measures, locking people up and drugging them against their will, including in the community. So those are kind of my initial thoughts.
Yeah, and I want to emphasize that as I've been reviewing the press, this is across the political spectrum. This is not limited to the right, although I think the NRA's call for a national mental health registry is probably the most wicked suggestion of all. But this is something that people get into because they want to believe there's a mental illness that can be diagnosed, defined and diagnosed. They want to believe that psychiatry has some power to determine who's violent and who isn't. And they want to believe that that drugs are going to help. And none of this is true. There's not a single drug approved for violence. And they often produce violence, but as you pointed out, only rarely horrendous violence, but enough to be a serious risk. In my new blog on the website, for the first time, I put a link in to data I had from way back from the FDA showing that Eric Harris had Luvox in his bloodstream at the time, proving it, that he had it in, at the time, from the autopsy. And this was a report from the manufacturer, Salve, into the FDA. And that has not been available up to now. And people are trying to avoid that issue, too. They're calling, in retrospect, that Harris was a psychopath. And if you look at Harris's profile over the years, I was able to, as an expert in cases surrounding him, he just got more and more psychotic in a very, very manic fashion, which is a typical Luvox effect. 4% of children in the label, they admit, will get manic on this drug, a horrendous number. And, of course, it could be much worse in general practice and over many, many months and years. So there's no question in my mind that that was the case. It was drug-induced. But I'm seeing this from both sides of the fence coming about. Maybe you could talk, and I can talk about what the dangers would be if we started to, and the absurdities and ridiculousness if we tried to do a mental health, mental illness registry in the country. You want to say something about that?
Well, obviously it's a big impingement on civil liberties. But I actually have to tell you, Dr. Bregan, and I may sound a little bit like a conspiracy theorist, which I intend not to most of the time, is that I have so many experiences of people going into, for example, an emergency room that have a psychiatric history, or even being again any kind of involvement with the police. And they, you know, put their name in, you know, the computer, and the next thing they know, they're in a psych ward. So I think there's a big chunk of that already happening.
Yes.
So the...
Yes, there
I mean,
is a big chunk.
Fundamentally, I think you know, as you, I think, always do, just, you know, really nail it on the right on target, that psychiatry doesn't have the answers. And so it's just this, the whole idea is, it's basically a charlatan profession, and to the extent that they pretend that they have these answers. And we know, as you pointed out, kind of I first became aware of it when reading Toxic Psychiatry, psychiatry causes far more harm than good, and that it's not solving problems, and it's creating more psychiatric symptoms than it's causing. And so to put, you know, so that's, I think that's the big picture, and having, you know, some kind of list that people get put on. I mean, there a few years ago, there was an estimate that 50% of the United States population would have, you know, a mental illness. And so, I mean, at that point, what's normal? I mean, I think it just demonstrates
the
absurdity of the current system.
Yeah, I mean, the claims come out all the time to promote psychiatry. They come out of APA, the Psychiatric Association. They come out of the NIMH, the government, that at least 20% of people a year will have a serious psychiatric problem, and half over a lifetime, and that's a huge list. And I think about my practice when I was in Washington, D.C. You know, I saw people who had top security clearances in the White House. I saw FBI people, and I saw our military attachés to embassies. I mean, all of these people, because they went to a psychiatrist, presumably, if it could be found out. Now, I withheld any data from anybody about anything, obviously. It's all secret. But if that data could be forced out of modern psychiatrists and psychotherapists and psychologists and counselors, first of all, nobody's going to seek treatment. Nobody with any sense will seek treatment if there's a national registry. I would advise people to avoid certainly any kind of formal treatment if they're going to go into a national registry. And who goes in? I mean, what's mental illness? It doesn't make any sense. The other part of it is that every single shooter, and this is interesting, they all pass through psychiatry in some way. And of course, we look at the Newtown youngster from a wealthy family, almost with diagnoses that were made by neighbors and relatives, and description of him being on medication in the Washington Post. Certainly he had psychiatric exposure, and we see what good it did him. We know that the shooter in Virginia Tech actually about a year earlier had been in a mental hospital, had been court-ordered to be supervised, and he just disappeared and avoided them. We know that Eric Harris was in treatment for a year with psychiatry, seen his records, and he just got worse and worse because they mistreated him, gave him a psychiatric drug, Luvox, that makes people manic and psychotic, which is what happened to him. And we even know that the Aurora shooter, a theater shooter, had been identified as a possible danger at the university, and then was allowed to just go about his business when he stopped going to school. So one of the things we're going to see is that the clever people, the canny people, the shrewd people who can end up committing these horrendous but usually highly planned crimes are going to be just the ones that sneak through the psychiatric net. They know enough when to split. They know enough when to shut up. Whereas it's going to be your people who are more honest, the more good-natured, but are having emotional problems, are going to get caught up and locked up as dangers. And the fact that all these people slipped through indicates the ineffectiveness, that meeting the psychiatric system didn't do anything for them. And by the way, Jim, I apologize. I'm doing more talking than I usually do in my own show because I'm just so invested in this. So I want to just turn it over to you now and let you talk some.
No, well, that's good. I mean, I think you're very, much more knowledgeable on this than I am, and I'm happy to contribute in whatever way I can. I mean, I think one of the things that's really clear from the research is that, official psychiatry admits that they have no special expertise in predicting violence. And it's, I think you made this point in your blog, is that after the fact, you can always go and point out to, warning signs and stuff. But ahead of the fact, and, before the event, you can't really pick people out ahead of time who are going to do such a rare thing. It's just not possible. And so that's just a fraudulent process on the part of psychiatrists who say that they can predict violence. And people are really, the truth is that people are locked up because they're disturbing, which can cover a gamut of things. But basically, because they're disturbing other people is why they're locked up. They might be disturbing them because, the family member, whatever it is. So there's that piece of it. Another thing that I think that I really wanted to make the point on this show is the public's right to know about these psychiatric drugs. And I think time after time, the facts about the implication of or involvement of psychiatric drugs is really being suppressed from the public. And I think the public has the right to know, and I think it's one of the things that the media fails to push, and it's one of the things that they should push, I mean, there were 26 homicides, and that's a public matter, and the public has the right to know what the police find out. And, you know, later there are likely to be civil lawsuits where some of this information is probably going to be made available, and then that information very well will likely be suppressed by the court and the parties. And that, I think, is also improper, that even in those kind of civil suits, the public has the right to know what happened. And it's possible to get these types of documents unsealed. I mean, you've been involved in many cases where documents are sealed, and I hope you would agree with me about this. You have to comply with the court's orders on this, but I suspect that you agree that there are many very important facts that are just withheld from the public in litigation.
Well, there's just a huge amount that's withheld. Fortunately, in cases that were settled against Glaxo, where I made this extensive report on Paxil, by a mistake made by the drug company in a later suit, when they challenged me, they opened the door to our bringing my report, 30 or 40 pages, into court, and that made it public. And that was a rare example, and I wrote three scientific articles based on that material finally coming forward, including that they were hiding suicide, manipulating their data. This is GlaxoSmithKline, so suicides wouldn't show up, including that people got very, very serious psychiatric adverse effects from 1-2-3 doses, including that agitation and akathisia, which is this agitation where you have to move around, that these things were associated with suicide. So, and that was all very important data, but it only got out because the drug company made a mistake in a later suit in which I was involved, said I had no data to back myself up with, whereupon the lawyer said on our side, oh, we have a whole big report that they won't release. Here it is. Yeah, there's so much. And the media just is so lockstep with the drug companies. I mean, they're so dependent on drug company money and the interlocking boards of directors that they just won't tell the truth. Interestingly enough, a couple of years ago, just recently, USA Today reviewed the Columbine shootings and said, we now know that Eric Harris wasn't taking a psychiatric drug. And I wrote them. Sent him a letter to the editor, said, that's absolutely untrue. Here's the data. Here's the number of the report to the FDA. I can send it to you. I never heard from them. I'll tell you something interesting that has come up, though. Two really important people on different sides of the political spectrum have now said on TV that that psychiatric drugs can be involved in this violence. Sanjay Gupta on CNN said that. And then Tom Ridge, the former head of our national security people, the Homeland Security people, and a governor, came out and said that. But I think, it hasn't come up again, and I think partly they're bringing it up to distract from the gun control issue. But I think it's died back. But that was missed, and I'm going to put some of that up on our website eventually, because we got the film of these guys saying that, which was a big surprise to me.
Yeah, it's a big surprise to me. I didn't see Dr. Gupta say that, because my impression of him is that he really basically is just reports what the medical industry.
Well, that's
Gibson.
Right, and I was very surprised, and I'm glad I have it on video, and we will get that out in the next week or so. He came out and pretty much said there's no doubt, and he even said it causes impulsivity or disinhibition, something along those lines. But I think that was like some burst that I was on the media from both these sides. I was very surprised by it, but I think they got shut up right away. But it's interesting that I now know that what I've been saying for all these years has actually reached ears, and it just popped out of a couple of mouths. this whole thing just raises so many, many different issues. As you know, I'm not someone that favors big government or government control. But given that we will never be able to stop very disturbed people, very angry, violent people, or disinhibited on street drugs or psych drugs from committing violence, I think it's becoming more and more clear that something's got to be done about how readily available tools of mass violence are in the country. And that's become very hard for me, but I'm thinking more and more about it. And my big concern is that, you know, people act as if what happened in Newtown is, you know, boy, that's about the worst you could imagine. Well, I mean, if one allows his imagination to run, and I won't give in any details, one can easily imagine two people, like we had in Columbine, killing a lot more people than that. And I think the copycats are going to increase. I think the violence on these games is training people to do it, and the violence in the movies encourages them. So I'm finally, you know, thinking we have got to do something about this while staying within the right to keep and bear arms. But that isn't, you know, we don't keep bazookas and we don't keep RPGs and so on, and there's got to be some limit. But I'm sure you favor that, I would think. That probably comes more easily to you than to me, Jim Gottstein.
Well, it might surprise you to learn that I've always felt that the Second Amendment was a personal right. Just from reading the text of the Second Amendment. But at the same time, like all other constitutional rights, it's not absolute. And it seems clear beyond doubt that the level of violence that we have in this country is just due to the ready availability of these types of weapons. And in countries where you don't have that, you just don't have the violence. I mean, we get the report that on the same day as Newtown, there was, you know, someone in China who went into school with a knife, and, you know, a couple of children were injured, but none killed. And if you just don't have at hand those kinds of instruments of death, then it's just not possible to kill as many people. So it seems to me that we have to really, I think, come to our senses and put restrictions on the types of weapons that people can have. And I think to focus on the size of the clips makes a lot of sense. I understand that the assault weapons ban that we had before was not really very sensible in terms of what it allowed and what it didn't allow. And it seems to me that something people really aren't talking about, but really ought to be, is that we have, you know, how many hundreds of thousands of these weapons already out there?
And millions. Oh, millions.
Well, millions of guns overall. I don't know about assault weapon types, but maybe millions of those too. But maybe millions of those, and that it seems to me that we really need to outlaw the possession of those, not just the sale of new ones.
Yeah. Well, we're getting close to break. When we come back, I want to talk about how many laws there are already in place for involuntary treatment. I think the public has no idea how easy it is for an ordinary citizen to get locked up. And let me just outline that right now. I mean, we've got a couple of minutes. People don't realize this. First, we have what's called certification, which is that in every state, some kinds of public officials and health officials can lock you up either on their signature or two signatures sometimes, I believe. So that, like in Colorado, where they were talking about, well, you know, we need stronger laws. In Colorado, almost any person in the health profession and anybody with any kind of official position can certify a person into a hospital. And
I get
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I get calls or emails every week from some person who was living just a normal life and then had something happen, and the next thing they knew, the police were at their door hauling them off to the psych hospital.
This really happens, folks. Then there's, if you go voluntarily into a mental hospital, in pretty much any state, they can hold you, even though you're voluntary, until they can get a commitment process going. Then, if you're certified into the hospital, then inevitably, if they want to go before a judge for the second step of involuntary commitment, that's not hard to do at all. And Jim, maybe you can talk about this more when we come back, but hardly anybody ever wins a contest against their own, the doctors who are treating them when they try to involuntarily hospitalize them. And then finally, in 44 states right now, as a result of this process, you can finally end up in court and be outpatient committed. That means you're an involuntary patient subject to forced drugging and return to the hospital without any other process. So they can just send you home, and if you don't show up at the clinic in 2 weeks for your shot, which will partially paralyze and immobilize you for 2 weeks, they just go out and get you and shoot you up. Involuntary commitment on an outpatient basis. And we'll talk more about that and some other issues as we come back after the break. This is Dr. Peter Breggin with my guest, Jim Gottstein from Alaska. You can get in touch with Jim and learn about his work through psychrights.com. Jim?
.org.
.org. Psychrights.org. Jim, you probably have as much experience as anybody in the world with dealing with these broad issues of involuntary commitment. Can you give some examples for people? You gave one. I think it could really bring it home. To give examples of just how bad it can be for people once they're locked up.
Well, I mean, that's how bad it can be. I mean, I sometimes liken being in a psychiatric hospital to being like Alice in Wonderland falling through the rabbit hole. I mean, it's just this bizarre place where everything that one does or said is written down as a psychiatric symptom, where if you don't want to do what, you know, what they want you to do, they will just make you do it. With the application of force, where they will tell you one thing and do another, which is kind of crazy making. What you find time and time again is that the problems caused by the psychiatric hospitalization end up being far more of a problem than whatever it was that brought the person into the hospital in the first place. Before the break you talked about these involuntary commitment laws and forced drugging laws, and that's an area where I feel a lot more comfortable on. And you're absolutely right that all 50 states have laws that allow people to be just summarily picked up and taken into the hospital. And the basic thesis upon which people are locked up and drugged against their will just don't in fact exist. So for example, people are purportedly locked up because they're a danger to self or others, when my estimate is that no more than 10% of the people locked up in psychiatric hospitals actually pose a danger to themselves or others. And so it's all this big sham, and it's based on fear. You know, and it's based on this fear that if we don't lock these crazed people up, they're going to come murder us in our homes. And then what happens is we have a Sandy Hook type tragedy, and that gets seized on to reinforce that idea. But the truth is that those events are just so small, and that people diagnosed with serious mental illness do not pose a larger risk of violence than the general population. So it's basically a dishonest process. And where I put, I mean, you can put the blame, I think, in both of our professions, respective professions, is that I think that the psychiatric profession does not tell the truth to the judges to get people locked up. And the lawyers assigned to represent people basically don't do their job. I mean, they're there because the courts have said people are entitled to a lawyer before they're locked up, and so they get to check that box off. But they don't really represent what their client wants. And in many, many cases, I'd say the majority of the cases, well, I don't know about the majority, but many cases, the lawyer doesn't even meet their client until right before the hearing. There were two studies done by this law professor in San Diego, Grant Morris, one about 20 years ago, and then more recently, just a few years ago, he followed up. And the average mental health commitment hearing was under 5 minutes. The lawyers don't ever call any witnesses on behalf of their clients, but how could they if they haven't even picked up the file until a few minutes before the hearing? So the whole legal process is basically a sham. And I think the big reason why this is tolerated is again, this public perception that we need to lock people up for our own and their safety, and that this so-called treatment is in their best interest. And so the judges believe that, and the lawyers assigned to represent the defendants in these cases believe that. And so the result is, well, if this person wasn't crazy, she'd know this is good for her, and therefore we won't let her pesky legal rights get in the way of doing to her what is really good for her. And that's all based on falsehoods. And so that's why I think what you're doing with this show and other people and what we're trying to do to get really the truth out is so important, is that we need the public to understand that this is all a house of cards built on this illusion of psychiatric certainty.
Very, very, very well said. The most of the violence that I see in terms of mental patients over the years, working in hospitals and now looking at case records and talking to patients, ex-patients, most of it is provoked by the psychiatric system. Many people end up getting so humiliated and feeling so abused that they lose their self-control in the hospital, and then that becomes used as a justification for hospitalizing them further and calling them violent. It should take an ordinary person who's used to keeping their own clothes, eating when they want to eat, going to bed when they want to go to bed, who's used to having company and freedom and books to read and whatever else. You take that person, you throw them in a hospital against their will, out of the emergency room. They're already upset and anxious, so they probably wouldn't have got caught in the net anyway. So they're frightened, they're feeling humiliated and feeling some sort of threat to themselves emotionally. And then you put them in that situation where you completely humiliate them, often under the management of people who are incredibly calloused and insensitive, starting with the psychiatrist and then going all the way down to the aides. So a lot of how people are kept in hospitals against their will is because they have freaked out in the hospital and become violent. That is, they've resisted the violence being perpetrated against them. They resisted the violence being perpetrated against them.
Well, yes, and as you know, that many psychiatric patients are far more knowledgeable about the effect of the drugs the harmfulness of the drugs than the psychiatrists and other staff at the hospital. And the other thing that I find very offensive is that when people report how the drugs make them feel, that they dismiss even the reports about how people feel because they're, quote, mentally ill or crazy. And so then you have someone who says, we want you to take these drugs, and if you don't take them, we're going to force you. And you know that those drugs literally are poison. And then, any kind of resistance to that, of course, is marked down as part of your mental illness. Saying that the drugs are poison or even harmful is marked as being, lack of insight and all those kind of things.
Oh, no, it's a delusion. You just expressed the delusion, Mr. Gottstein, when you said the drugs are poison.
Exactly. And so, you asked for an example before, and one of them is Faith Myers, who I represented in my first Alaska Supreme Court win. In that case, she was home cooking dinner when the police barged through the door, broke her glasses, broke her finger, and dragged her off to the hospital. She actually didn't get violent, but that kind of thing could cause, anybody to become violent. And then, at one point, later in her stay, and I kept telling her, look, she'd been had voluntarily taken Novan, a Thorazine-like medication, for 20 years. And it was actually when she was switched to Risperdal that was the first time she ever became psychotic. But anyway, there are two legal justifications for drugging someone against their will. The first is basically, oh, this is good for you. You're so crazy you don't know it's good for you, so we'll make you do it. It's called the parents' patriae doctrine, which means we'll act as your parent because you don't have enough sense to make decisions for yourself. But the other is the police power justification, which is for safety. And those... the idea is that if someone is so out of control in the hospital that they're an extreme danger to someone else or themselves, that the hospital can give them usually what's called a PRN, right, as needed. And in the hospital, Faith got frustrated with someone and dumped a box of crayons on someone's head, on one of the staff members' head. And that was... listed as or just was given as a justification for giving her an injunction against her will. And this was while I basically had a stay in effect while we were litigating this. So I had another case where I took the deposition of a psychiatrist, and she didn't even know the legal requirement for using what's called emergency medication. That's the police power medication. And she would say, I forget what it was, but one of them was agitation. Well, the statute says that you can use emergency medication if serious illness or death is imminent. This hardly amounts to that. And people are given these drugs based on this, police power emergency justification for yelling.
Yeah, absolutely. None of this is being exaggerated, folks. And as I'm thinking this through with my guest, Jim Gottstein, who you can find on psychrights.org, my big fear... In fact, I predict that we're going to see more and more of the holdout states under pressure from the drug companies and the psychiatric association passing involuntary outpatient commitment laws. so that more and more Americans, there's only like 15 or 16 states that haven't got it now. And I think that this is going to be increased in the states that have it and made easier and brought into the states that don't. That psychiatry can literally reach out its arm to keep you under its control when you're outside the hospital. And some of the most piteous or pitiable calls or phone calls and contacts I get are from people around the country who are on drugs that, as Jim Gottstein described, are poisonous, drugs that poison the brain, that cause atrophy of the brain, that cause apathy and indifference that can become like a permanent lobotomy, drugs that cause very premature death, some studies showing up to 20 years premature death, that cause a metabolic syndrome with overweight and elevated cholesterol and elevated sugar and even diabetes, that these extremely toxic drugs like Risperdal and Zyprexa and Seroquel and Novane and Innovate and so on, that these drugs can be forced on you for the rest of your life, guaranteeing that your quality of life will fall through your hands like sand and that you'll have an earlier death. And that this goes on now and people can't escape it and it will increase. And the second big fear, and I predict that there will be a movement in this direction, it's already taking place as Obamacare goes into effect. The states, as a doctor, I've already been contacted about this and told I have to participate in this. I'm not sure what it's going to head up to, but we're centralizing records. I'm in New York State, centralizing records under health care now. As it becomes more under government control, there's going to be easy access to those records. They'll also be available if the next step is a national registry. So I think we're at a very critical period of time, and we really need to take active stands against the increase in psychiatric power at this point. Do you think I'm exaggerating? Do you have the same concerns?
You know, I do. And one of the things I might mention, since I'm a lawyer and you have me on, is kind of the legal aspect of this outpatient commitment, is that in New York it was challenged on constitutional grounds. And I'm going to ask you, do you know on what basis the New York Court of Appeals, which is the highest court in New York, ruled that it was constitutional?
No.
It was ruled constitutional because it was not a statute that required anybody to take psychiatric drugs against their will. And so is that a stunned silence? I mean,
wow.
They said it doesn't require anybody to take psychiatric drugs. All it does is if you don't take it, then that causes this heightened security scrutiny. And then if, you know, the psychiatrist says, well, this person is dangerous, then they can be hauled back into inpatient. So it was a complete legal fiction as to why it was held constitutional. And one of the things that I would really like to see is for more lawyers to really recognize what a horror this forced psychiatry is, involuntary commitment and forced medication is, and realize what harm it was doing and join the effort to fight this huge deprivation of people's liberty to their great harm.
I'm with you 100%. I'd like to just, since we're getting near the end, we've got about six minutes left. I'd like to talk about the schools and the young people in the schools who end up committing the shootings. Every single case that I've been able to look into, which is a lot, and the ones I've been more closely involved with, indicate that every single one of these people who end up being shooters is somebody who is outside of the usual community of the school. That is, they felt isolated, they felt
ashamed. They felt like they didn't belong. In just about every case, really every case, though we don't have any data yet on Newtown, and all the other cases I've looked at, and I'm talking about dozens, there was bullying of these kids because they were unusual, because they were different, because they were socially isolated. Now, this fits with my understanding of personal violence, which is that all of it comes out of feeling humiliated and shamed. That's an important insight that all the talking head psychiatrists aren't talking about because they're so enamored with false theories. The simple truth is...
misfiring neurons.
Yeah, exactly. The truth is, people get violent, whether it's road rage, whether it's in a bar, whether it's planned out and it's in a school, whether it's in a family, domestic setting. People are violent usually because they feel overwhelmingly humiliated. Even the big, strong man who beats his wife, you really deal with him, get to know him. He feels like women overpower him. Of course, it's untrue, but that's what he feels. He feels humiliated by women. And we have to look at these youngsters that we are seeing out there who are feeling humiliated, ashamed, isolated, and alone. We have to make our schools more welcoming places for them. And we need to make it more welcoming in the therapy community to families who are having these kinds of problems and are dealing with kids who are being isolated, because they're also isolated in their families. That's where it starts, this isolation. Now, as long as we're thinking psychiatry, it won't work, because it further diagnoses. It'll call them autistic or Asperger's or that's going out of vogue, or whatever the new one is, bipolar. They'll call them names in psychiatric terms. Here's my bad name for you. And they'll give them drugs. And they'll tell the parents they're not responsible for any of this, so the parents don't have to improve their parenting skills and get some help, try to reinclude the kid into the family. So the problem is that these kids do need something. Their families need something. But the current problem is that if we take the approach of trying to identify kids who are in trouble and who are on the margins, they're not going to get what they need, which is a loving, caring counseling that involves their families and tries to bring them, back into the community again. They're going to get humiliating diagnoses and drugs. So a person like myself who wants to see more offered is really in a quandary. And so I'm doing a lot of work, as you know, Jim, on trying to encourage the profession to all the health professions to be thinking more empathically and caring and less psychiatrically toward people. But that's a terrible problem right now. Now, I don't think that we will stop violence by reaching out to kids, because it's such a rare event. I'm not sure that if we had more caring schools and less bullying in schools, we'd have less of these rare violence. I would hope we would have less. But certainly we would help a lot of kids, because an awful lot of young people feel isolated and feel alone. I don't know if you have any particular thoughts on that.
Well, I have two, really. One is related to your point that all of these shooters basically have had psychiatric involvement. And just think about what would have happened if they had been given empathic, care and understanding of what they were going through and help with what they were going through, rather than this fraudulent idea that they have something wrong with their brain. You know, how many of these tragedies could have been prevented? And the other thought that I had as you were talking is that there is a really large financial incentive for many people in the system for children and, in fact, adults to get diagnosed. Children, if you're identified as a special needs child student, then the school district gets more money. In foster care, if it's a, quote, therapeutic foster care, then the foster parents get more money. And then, of course, the doctors and social workers and everybody all have financial gains when children and other people get given psychiatric diagnoses.
Jim, we're at the end. I want to thank Jim Gottstein psychrights.org, the most brave and active attorney that I know in the whole field of patient rights. He's in Alaska. He's devoted his life to these issues. And I thank you very, very, very much for being on the Dr. Peter Bregenauer. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.